Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Millions of Nepalese have been impacted by the magnitude 7.8 earthquake that hit the landlocked South Asian nation on Saturday. Initial estimates of the dead were 1,200, but that more than doubled to about 4,000 yesterday. Now, Nepal's Prime Minister Sushil Koirala has announced that the final death toll could reach 10,000. Bodies still remain trapped and rescue efforts are in full force. The earthquake triggered an avalanche on Mount Everest and tremors were felt in cities outside the country. Some remote villages as much as 70% are wiped out. Those living in homes made of heavy boulders were more likely to have suffered damage and death compared to those living in wooden structures. Hundreds of thousands of ordinary Nepalese are living on the streets, either from fear of a major aftershock or from simply having lost their home. A public outpouring of financial support has begun, but funds need to be immediately mobilized to get help fast where needed. In countries as poor as Nepal, the aftermath of a natural disaster can be even more devastating than the actual event. My guest is Darius Teeter, Vice President of Programs at Oxfam. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you. Good morning, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. How important is the backdrop of poverty to the story of Nepal's earthquake? Would there have been possibly fewer deaths and less damage if the same magnitude earthquake had hit a wealthier country with better infrastructure?
It's absolutely true. The correlation between poverty and suffering and disasters is well documented. And just to give you some statistics to put this in perspective, 55% of Nepalese live below the poverty line. And a typical Nepali has 3 years of schooling compared to 13 in the United States. We enjoy 25 doctors for every 10,000 people in the United States. The comparative statistic in Nepal is only 2 doctors. We have reliable electricity, excellent transportation and communications links, and perhaps most importantly, we have a government present in almost every level of the country. And the Nepalese don't enjoy any of those luxuries, and that matters in terms of human life.
Now, is it true, I mentioned that the aftermath of a natural disaster in a very poor country can be even worse than the actual disaster itself. And I'm thinking of Haiti, for example, where the earthquake there, you saw the aftermath. Some estimates put even more people having died after the earthquake than during.
It's tragically that's the case. Our number one concern in Nepal, you have tens of thousands of people who are afraid to return to their homes either because they're damaged or destroyed or because of aftershocks. And when you have that many people living out in the open, the number one risk is waterborne diseases like cholera and dysentery. So clean water and sanitation, basic shelter and food, that's the story for this week. And without those things, you get a second disaster, frankly.
Who are the most vulnerable in the aftermath of this crisis? Are you looking particularly at children?
It's women and children. Women and children bear the brunt of poverty, and so they bear the brunt of emergencies. This situation is exacerbated in Nepal because so many men migrate either out of Nepal or at least out of their villages in search of basic employment and work. So you have women who are already responsible for raising the children, maintaining the household, and feeding their families, now also alone, trying to respond and survive this emergency.
And so there are, I'm imagining, still rescue efforts taking place. Is it possible that there might be more lives that can be saved? Is it possible for people to have survived under the rubble still?
We're approaching day 4. It's becoming increasingly unlikely, but we've had situations in the past where people were pulled out of the rubble 5-6 days after a disaster. So we still hope and pray that more lives can be saved. We are in Oxfam, we're really focusing our effort on the next phase, which is making sure that people have clean water, food, and shelter. And we're injecting some cash into little tiny businesses so that the informal economy can be kickstarted and people can start to help themselves.
How is transportation of these supplies taking place when there's so much infrastructure damage? And there's some fear, I understand, of aftershocks.
So the logistics are incredibly difficult in Nepal, even without an earthquake. I've trekked all through this region, and you run into government officials on the path who are walking for 3 days just to do their monthly round where they provide some basic service. You know, they may be a judge or a doctor or a public health worker or a social worker. So even without an earthquake, it's a four-day walk to half the country that they might want to serve from where they, you know, can park their truck. It's much, much worse now.
And so specifically, you mentioned a little bit of what Oxfam was doing. Specifically, you are trying to, in addition to kickstarting some local businesses with money, you're also trying to provide direct food and water aid, medicines, I'm guessing?
We've had an office in Nepal for almost 40 years. We have 75 people on the ground right now, and people arriving every day, more people and more equipment. Our focus right now is in these open-air camps that I mentioned, where there's some 30,000 people living on, you know, in under tarps in the Kathmandu Valley. We're providing drinking water, basic sanitation, emergency food supplies, shelter, sanitation kits, and some cash, injecting some cash into the economy. That's our focus this week. We're also doing assessments in rural areas. And, you know, because we're a long-term organization, we have a long-term relationship in Nepal, we are really focused on helping local organizations and local communities because, frankly, they are the first responders, and they're the ones who are really understand the local context, understand the local culture. So our focus is very strongly in working with local communities.
And are you hopeful that there may be international aid also trickling in addition to members of the public in countries like the U.S. donating directly to Oxfam? Is there talk yet of government aid?
Yes, so I think I understand the U.S. government made a substantial commitment and then increased it again yesterday. A lot of governments across the world, Europe, India, have committed assistance and personnel. So it's ramping up now. This is the tough couple of weeks because basic financial assistance is really crucial. It's actually more important than, you know, we're tempted to, you know, send clothing or send canned goods, but the logistics of delivering that kind of stuff is almost impossible. So the urgent need right now is basic financial, whatever modest contribution people can make.
And Darius, I'm so glad you brought that up because our tendency, particularly here in the United States in the aftermath of a disaster, is to look through our closets to see how we can donate our used clothes and shoes, et cetera. I'm sure it comes from a good place, but as you mentioned, the costs are prohibitive to even get it there in the first place. But isn't there, when people do donate money, the double impact of having the money trickle through the local economy?
That's absolutely right. People don't need what's in our closets, frankly. What they need is a little bit of they need food and water right now to survive, and then they need a little bit of money to help restock their wares and get their businesses going. Most of Nepal is employed by the informal economy. These are entrepreneurial people. They know how to make business and how to take care of themselves and each other. They need a little help to get started. So we really try to focus on what they need to reestablish their lives and their income.
And then there are concerns, of course, when people do give money that too much of that money trickles to salaries of CEOs and overhead costs. I know there were concerns around the International Red Cross, where there was an expose of it some years ago. How do you make the case for donations to your organization?
Well, all of our financial data is absolutely transparent to the public. Organizations like Charity Navigator and the Better Business Bureau review our books and they give us ratings on how we're doing. So we open ourselves up to third-party verification of all of our work, and all of that information is available on OxfamAmerica.org. So and most organizations are trying to do the same. So I encourage listeners to educate themselves and to look deeply into what they can find in the publicly available domain.
So Oxfam America is the website. Give that out again. Is that where people can make donations?
Oxfam America, one word, .org, and we have a relief and recovery fund specifically set up for Nepal, and it's the first thing you'll see when you go to the website. And the good thing about that fund is we use it for this very quick, urgent relief now, but we also allocate funding for the longer-term rebuilding of the economy and of people's livelihoods.
Well, Darius, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck in your work in Nepal.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest, Darius Teeter, is the Vice President of Programs at Oxfam. Again, that website, oxfamamerica.org. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll go live to Baltimore. Stay tuned.